Good afternoon. Hi, and welcome to FSCom's latest webinar, preparing for an IT audit. My name is Elaine Tai, and I am the organizer of today's webinar. I head up the marketing in FSCom. So look, just a bit of housekeeping and to start off, if you do have any technical difficulties with audio or viewing the webinar, please refer to your confirmation email. Or feel free to private message me in the chat area or email marketing@fscom.co.uk and the team can pick it up there. So just a reminder, you have all joined the webinar in listen-only mode, which means you're muted on entry. But look, we will please encourage you to, you know, ask as many questions as possible for the panel session later on, and ask those questions using the chat form at the side, and then I will read them out to our presenters. So look, just to start off, I will now introduce the presenters. We have Simon Whittaker and Greg James, both of who you can see there. So Simon Whittaker is FSCom's subject matter expert in all things relating to IT and cybersecurity. And Greg James is our subject matter expert in operational and security risk. So look, before I hand over to Simon to kick things off, I'm just going to give you an outline of how this will work today. So Simon is going to present for 20 to 30 minutes initially, and then Greg will come back on for the Q&A panel session. So please use the opportunity, ask as many questions as possible. And for those that we don't get answering today, we will come back to you after the webinar today. So over to you, Simon.
Thanks very much, Elaine. Really appreciate that. Looking forward to spending some time chatting with everybody today. Hopefully some people that I've met before and maybe some that I haven't, but it's very, very nice to meet you. I am, as Elaine says, work with FSCom from the cybersecurity side of the world, something I'm very passionate about, been working on for a long time. I'll talk more about that in a wee second, but just to kind of give you an idea about what we're going to talk about today, there's about four or five different points that I wanted to cover today. First is around the guidelines themselves. What do they say? What do they mean? Why are they there? All that sort of stuff. Then moving into what does an audit look like? So how do we conduct our audits? Moving on then to what do we need to do? And then thinking about some of the documents and all the fun processes and things like that we request and we ask for from people we're going in to speak with. And then thinking about follow up as well. So as I say, just a little bit about me. I've been working in the area of cybersecurity now since about 2006, 2007, something like that. It never used to be called cybersecurity. When I started, it's quite a new term as far as I'm aware, and far as we can tell. I initially started out working with oil and gas companies, and we're working with oil and gas companies in the Middle East, in Europe, in America, and security was never mentioned. And then we started working with Russian oil and gas firms, and security was the number one thing that they asked about. And that ignited a passion in me for security and helping people to understand the security that they were facing. We've been very interesting to become involved over the last few years with the financial services industry. We've gained a great deal of experience of auditing and understanding how financial services companies work, and hopefully expertise that we're going to bring to the IT audits. So my email address is on the screen there. It'll be in the slides as well. So if there's anything that I can help with, please drop me a line. And also, I think Elaine's got her email address of marketing@fscom in the pack there as well. So let's think about the guidelines here and why we're actually here. So there's new guidelines come into force on 30th of June 2020. They replace the previous guidelines. the GL 2017-17, which were issued into 2017, and they are fully integrated into these guidelines, and they'll be repealed once these guidelines become applicable. One of the things I would point out is the nice snappy URL here. Don't bother trying to write it out. We'll provide the slides, and then you can just click through straight into the links yourselves. The URL is nearly as long as the actual document itself, as far as I can work out. Also, just to be aware that there are about 129 pages in the document, which you know, obviously, you know, regulation is tough, and it's, you know, it's a hard thing to condense down, and you've got to be clear and specific. But what I would say is that, from my point of view, the really interesting stuff is around about pages 14 through 29. That's those are the ones that I would maybe focus on for the IT audit side of things. And actually, I have to say, I think they make quite a lot of sense in many cases. I think that there is a lot of good stuff in there. I think there's a lot of very useful advice and guidance that is issued within the guidelines, and something that we should be definitely taking advantage of. One of the things I would say is about compliance and proportionality. Okay, so what it says in the guidelines are that all financial institutions should comply with the provisions set out in these guidelines in such a way that it is proportionate to and takes account of the financial institution's size, their internal organization, and the nature, scope, complexity, and riskiness of the services that the financial institutions provide or intend to provide. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, it's, in some readings of it, you could assume that if you're small, you don't have to do anything. That's not the case, as we'll all be aware. But what we do have to think about here is how we implement things. Okay, so we've worked with everyone from some of the challenger banks to fintech startups who have one employee or two employees and maybe a couple of different contractors in place. And what it just means is that we need to treat these guidelines with a sense of respect, but also a sense of understanding. So we don't need to, for instance, implement absolutely everything just because, you know, or the whole gamut of everything. What we do is we look at risk, and we start to accept risks, or we start to mitigate risks. Okay, and that's really important to be aware of. So it means things aren't as black and white as they might necessarily be. So it is important to remember your proportionality here, okay? It's really important to bring that into play. So why would you do an audit? Well, why would you do it? Well, it's to help you to provide you with assurance that your systems and processes meet the requirements of the guidelines. It also specifies that you should be audited externally by a party who understands IT audit, IT systems, a party who understands how your processes work, and you know, they should be from an external point of view. So it is very important that that the audits do take place. From my point of view, just to give you a little bit of background here. Before I got into cybersecurity, I was a software developer. I was a systems administrator for a while, a network administrator, technical sales stuff. I'm currently an AWS certified solutions architect and security specialist. And that means that I understand, and I look at the technical work that you're doing, and I understand your implementation of it. So that's a very useful thing to be able to go in and do it. We're not just you know, read the guidelines and ask irrelevant questions. What I try to do when I'm doing an audit is to ask you relevant questions which help you to shape how your the improvements that you'll make over the following year as well. So it's not just a one-off piece. So an audit is there to help you to get assurance that your systems and processes are meeting the requirements of the guidelines. That's a really important point to bring out. So what does an audit look like? Well, we look at a number of different things. Okay, so we'll slide back to the, we'll go back to the slide in a wee minute. Just to be clear, you know, the guidelines for cybersecurity are around having information security policies, logical security, physical security, ICT operations security, information security reviews and testing, training and awareness. So not just technical stuff, also about the training and awareness of your people. To answer the question, what does an IT audit look like? Well, normally it looks something like this. It's, obviously, this is Greg and I, who will, in some cases, will come to your office, maybe not at the moment, but in some cases, we'll come to your office and ask you and start asking questions. In other cases, we'll do it remotely. So we've been working with a lot of clients recently who we've just been sharing information over over Teams or over GoToMeeting or whatever medium they feel comfortable doing. So a remote IT audit doesn't need to necessarily cause any difficulties or any hassle. So let's go back just briefly around these EBA guidelines for cybersecurity. So the requirements there are really quite specific. They're quite clear. An information security policy. What does the information security policy mean? Well, it means it's your rules and governance document, essentially. So it needs to be about what you do as an organization, why security is important to you, who is impacted by your cybersecurity or in some cases your lack of cybersecurity. Thinking about interested parties, if we refer back to our 27001, ISO 27001 certification. So security policy is the key to everything, really. And what it tends to do is it tends to link off to a number of documents. So we'll ask for your security policy, and then we will probably be linking that off to a number of different places. From a logical security point of view, what do we need to be thinking about? Well, there's a lot of different areas. We need to be looking at principle of least privilege, need to know from a user access perspective, user accountability. We had a question from a client recently about access, about whether they were allowed to have a shared access to a CRM system because it was cheaper than buying their own, than buying an account per person. And actually, from an accountability point of view, that's a problem that we would have more than the license fee evasion that they were trying to do. But from the accountability function, it just means that you have no accountability of who is doing what. And especially when it comes to sensitive payment data, that is absolutely critical. So we would want to know about your accountability. How do you do your user authentication? How do you assign privileged access rights to your users? We want to see that. I will ask questions. If you're using AWS, I ask to see your console, your IAM console. I would be interested in looking at the logging, how you do logging of your user activities. Do you have your CloudWatch logs in AWS's case or other logs in the case of other cloud infrastructure? What about things like access management and authentication methods? So multi-factor authentication, do you do multi-factor auth to access your systems? Do you do multi-factor auth to access sensitive payment data? If the answer is no, then I would need to see an understanding of why that risk has been accepted. So you accept that risk because access to sensitive payment data is restricted using X, Y, and Z instead of using MFA, instead of using multi-factor authentication. Then we think about things like physical security. So this used to be a massive deal, obviously. We all had massive big data centers which we put our stuff into. Some people bought them, built them, or some people hired space or whatever. And we also had great physical security in our offices in many cases. Physical security now is a whole different matter and something that we are, we're working with clients to help them to understand, because I'm sitting in my home office here. I have a window just here through which it may be that somebody could jump through, grab one of my laptops. And yes, unfortunately, I'm that sort of person who has more than one, but grab one of my laptops and walk out the door, walk out the window again. So physical security has changed from having a security guarded office in the city where you can't get in unless you get buzzed to the right floor and accompanied at all times and all that sort of stuff. We now have access to critical information from many, many different locations. And that's something that we're really interested in seeing during the IT audits that we've been working on recently. And then we think about things like ICT operations security. So I would want to see when we're going through audits, where we're going through audits with clients, I expect to see things like patching plans. We also ask people to show us when the last time something was patched. So we might ask, for your critical systems, show us, records of your systems being patched for one of the latest systems. Think about things like secure baselines. So how do you build your systems, your servers that your applications sit on? What about network segmentation? Do you have your accounts team in the office on the same network, for instance, as you run your production infrastructure holding lots of sensitive client personal payment data? We would hope not. Endpoint protection. I would ask for people, I would ask to make sure that people have antivirus or anti-malware on their devices and on the potentially on the servers running in cloud infrastructure or beyond. So I would want to see those as well. So how do you manage your endpoints? How are you aware of those things? Okay. Encryption as well. You know, how do you encrypt your data at rest, in transit? Again, I ask for examples of these. Whenever we're doing audits, it's really useful to be able to speak with someone from the tech team who can then show us how they're using the encryption technologies. So, you know, showing us how their databases are encrypted at rest within RDS in AWS or within Azure or in their database management systems or locally, or what, it doesn't really matter where it sits, but what we're interested in is in understanding is how is it encrypted, who holds the keys, and why are they and what methods are you using for encryption. And then we think about things like monitoring as well. So how do you know you've been breached? So what do you do if do you find out because somebody sends you a ransom note, or you get put onto haveibeenpwned.com or, you know, one of those sort of sites? Or do you use some kind of monitoring facilities, some kind of threat intelligence to help you to understand what's happening beyond your firewall? So I've seen some fantastic products that help you to understand the, you know, do things like they put things like threat markers in where you put in fake data into your systems. And if that information ever appears on any systems that are, you know, publicly available, you know, dark websites, paste bin, dump sites, things like that, then you'll get notified. So from a detection point of view, that's really, really important to know about that. Another really important thing, I think, is around threat modeling as well. So, and I actually have a document down in my printer here, which is one of the latest documents about threat modeling. And what I love to see when I go into an organization to talk about threats and to talk about issues is evidence of threat modeling taking place. So have you sat down and thought about what threats actually are in place for your organization, for you as a company? So what is most likely to happen? And I think that's really important to bring out. The last couple of sections are around kind of information security reviews and testing and training and awareness. Reviews and testing, the guidelines specify that you should have security and penetration testing taking place at least annually for critical systems. That's all of your critical systems. That's something that that is required, and every 3 years from a non for your non-critical systems. Okay, and you know, that's something that we do on a regular basis. We do the security and penetration testing side of things, it's interesting when we go in for an audit like this and someone presents us with an audit, a scan of an IP address from 2016, for instance, which, you know, couldn't be can be the case. You know, that's not enough for meeting the guidelines that we've that have been established here. Okay, so it's really important that you think about testing taking place at least annually for critical systems and every 3 years for non-critical systems. And information security training and awareness is also an absolutely vital thing to be doing, because, you know, there's a great cartoon. I don't think I have it in this slide deck, where it talks about how in this corner we have antivirus, firewalls, all the bits and pieces, and in this corner we have Dave, human error in this corner, and Dave will always win without question. So thinking about your training and awareness, which I think is missed in many cases, but is actually part of your guidelines and is really, really an important thing to be doing. So again, just to have a think about, what does an audit look like? Well, an audit from this point of view, it looks like this sort of thing. So this is a sample audit. Okay, so we might come in and we might ask to look at your risk assessment and your assets. Think about discussing governance and a broad overview of your system to try to understand exactly where your risks may lie and how well have you matched up these between the risks, the real risks, and the risks that we're seeing in your risk assessment. We want to speak to your DevOps teams and have conversations with them. We want to review your cloud environment. So if you're using AWS, then we want to see that up on screen. We don't necessarily want to be clicking about at it because that can be not a good way to do things. What we do want to do is we want to see how things are going. And we want to look at things in your AWS IAM, like key age and users forced to have multi-factor authentication and decent password policies and things like that. We also want to think about your corporate exemption. We want to think about talking with your head of security. So as a IT cybersecurity professional, I want to understand about your I want to understand about your what your head of security considers is important from the cybersecurity side. So then we can have a conversation about what measures they've put in place, measures from a technical point of view and also from a non-technical point of view that they've put in place. So that's very useful. Business continuity, as I say, is vital for me as well. I really, really want to see how you deal with business continuity issues. And then we also talk protection, detection and risk assessment. I'll give you a bit of some clues here. So from a protection and a detection side, some of the things that really help to be able to solve problems from a protection and detection side, if I use AWS again as an example, being the security specialist from AWS with AWS certification, using things like guard duty with automated responses, that will help out in so many ways when it comes to thinking about your detection and protection side of things. Using things like AWS config, where your machines must all look the same, they must all have certain patches, that helps us with so many areas. These tools are really, really valuable for you. And regular review of them is also a significant part of that. One of the things I would also say is that we are we're looking to make sure that you're complying with the guidelines, but we're not there to catch you out. You know, what we're interested in is you presenting to us what your security measures have been and what you're doing to and how you're securing your systems. That's what we're really interested in. So show us your cloud console, especially from the protection and detection side. It really genuinely helps us out to be able to see those sort of bits and pieces. I've had some fantastic feedback from clients when we've been doing these IT audits sometimes, where they've actually said, you know, we've been talking about some of the tools and the measures that you can take as a, you know, within the cloud infrastructure, you know, they've discovered that very quickly and easily they can implement a full system for monitoring and logging what's happening in their infrastructure, just like that. You know, it's very, very useful to be able to do. So, what do you need to do? Well, from my point of view, the most useful thing that you can do when I come in to see you is to be aware of the guidelines. Okay, so know what they are. Have read them. You can talk to me about how you've implemented them within your organization, and you know that's such a great thing to be able to do when I go into a company and actually ask them. So you know, tell me about your detection, and there's just a story behind it. There's a story about how you're implementing it and why these things were chosen and why they're important to you. And then reflecting back onto, you know, this is why we chose this encryption setup for the database technology and things like that. So it can be really, really useful. So from a document point of view, what else do we want to see? Well, there is quite a list, but it's all doable. It's all relatively, relatively simple. But there is a wee bit of a list of documents that we would expect to see at a minimum. Okay. So we want to see security policies, risk assessments, your asset list, and by assets, you know, sometimes people think that we're interested in how many chairs and tables a company has, and actually that's not the case. What we're really interested in is the assets from an information security point of view. So a USB drive that can store all of your client's data on it that costs £3 from, you know, the local stationery shop is more valuable than the desk that costs £400 or whatever it was. So from an information security perspective, what are your assets? And your assets will be people, your assets will be devices, your assets will be data, they'll be your clients. So think about those sort of assets and then we can have a conversation about those. Training plans and evidence are really important to me as well. So really, I find it really useful to be able to see that people have done training. I always recommend that there is there's an NCSC training pack available, which we'll try to link to as well. There's an NCSC training pack available, and it's really, really good. The National Cybersecurity Center just gives a very basic overview on cybersecurity training, but it does mean that your team are then understanding security and are being in a measurable way, which is really useful. Your business continuity plans, as I've discussed, access management, as in how do you get access to your systems and sensitive payment data, supplier policy. I'm going to talk suppliers just before I finish off here, because they're absolutely vital to me. Dealing with your payment services user, your change management, and so how you deal with change within your organization, and remembering that at times, for instance, if you have a significant change in your infrastructure, move from AWS to Azure or Azure to in-house hosting or whatever it is you're doing, then there may be an additional requirement to perform security testing again. So you've got to be considering that and assessing the impact of the change. And then thinking vulnerability assessments, so thinking about things on a more regular basis. And the final thing really that I wanted to mention from this point of view is what I have been focusing on a lot with clients recently has been around suppliers. It came after the FCA released this set of information that 17% of the incidents firms reported to the FCA were caused by IT failure at a third-party supplier. I mean, if we think about it, how many people now have all of their development teams in-house? How many people have every single part of their systems in-house? Very, very rare. So some questions that I would be asking, I think are really important to ask about your suppliers is, how are your suppliers doing? How do you assess who they are? You know, do you use something like security scorecard, like we saw with a client who used it in a very effective way to understand their suppliers and state that if their suppliers fell below a grade C, for instance, then they had to have a conversation with the supplier. If the supplier fell below a grade D, then then further sanctions could take place. So with your suppliers, how would you know if your suppliers were compromised? Do you have effective contracts in place? How would you cope if they no longer existed? Working with a client a wee while back now, and their AWS account was actually owned by somebody else. So if that client if the company that owned the AWS account decided they fell out with them, or they decided they weren't around anymore, they decided they weren't going to pay it anymore, or they go bankrupt, then that impacts you directly, and that applies to your suppliers as well. So when they're developing something for you, make sure that takes place in your account. When you're doing your things like when they're storing code in GitHub, GitLab, or whatever version control system, make sure you are the owner of that project. Because if that company goes under, or they're no longer around, or you have a disagreement, then it's vital that you have control of that. That could impact directly your availability, and therefore require you to do some reporting to the FCA, but also cause you downtime with your clients as well. Minimum supply requirements. I've already spoken about how important it is to understand about the minimum supplier. What are your suppliers looking like? How do they look? What are they? Do they have any problems? Can you help them to get better? We have seen some clients who say you have to be ISO 27001 certified in order to do this. That's what we see sometimes. And the last thing is to follow up as well. So this isn't just us coming in might be a once a year thing, but it's supposed to be a useful process, and it's supposed to help you to understand your issues. So think about the follow-up. So, you know, when we provide guidance and feedback, you don't have to change everything to what I've said or what we've said. But what you should do is you should try to bear it in mind and think, well, that's a useful thing, we'll take that with us or whatever. But what we love to see is when we go and see a client in January 2019, and then we go back in 2020, and things have improved dramatically. It's such a great thing to have. And you know, as an auditor, it's great that you're able to kind of encourage organizations to continually improve and to keep on going. Okay, so that's pretty much it. Hopefully I will see some of you for an IT audit at some point in the future. I look forward to meeting you then. I'm going to Going to hand back to Elaine. I think probably Elaine has maybe a couple of questions that have come in.
Yes, look, Simon, thank you so much for that comprehensive tour, then through what firms should expect from the IT audit. I know there's a lot to it, but I think you covered that very succinctly there. So look, we'll move on to part two, which is the Q&A panel session, and welcome back, Greg. So a number of questions then. Okay. Number one then, Greg, maybe we can go to you for this one. Can you talk to us about the difference between the guidelines coming in and the previous guidelines?
Yeah, so Simon touched on it briefly there, but it's, if we look at them in their totality, it's really about how much more specific they've become. So for instance, it really goes into the, to what it expects you to have within your information security policy. Whereas the previous guidelines really didn't go into that. It just said that you had to have an information security policy. Didn't specifically say what you needed in there, such as logical security, physical security, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's probably the all-encompassing change. And then of course you have different guidelines have kind of come into this. And although they were touched on in the previous guidelines, this has become a lot more, it's become a lot clearer what exactly they're expecting here. That goes into really change in project management, operational management, the fact that they expect you to formulate a formal IT strategy. So how are you going to progress IT, both from an operational perspective, from a security perspective, and from a resilience perspective. And also it dives into a wee bit more detail when it comes to risk assessments, which will have a practical implication when it comes to your REPA 18s. And that is because it now says that effectively you have to score your assets in line with the CIA triad, so confidentiality, integrity, and availability of the asset. So that really should be tying in to your scoring of risks, is the value of the underlying asset. So I think those are the big key changes. There will be more nuanced changes in there, but I think that gives a good overview of exactly what's changed here.
Okay, Greg, thank you. Simon, anything to add to that?
My apologies, sorry. I forgot to hit unmute there. I don't think there's anything really to add. Just to back up what Greg said about the specificity of the new regulations, the new guidelines, I think it's actually very useful. I think that's quite a good move by the EBA for those. So I think that's going to be a good thing.
Okay, thank you. Right, we'll go on to the next question. Simon, what specific information do you need from the client before starting the IT audit?
Okay, so it will, from my point of view, what's really useful is to be able to get an understanding about the organization before I get there. It can be very handy to have an overview of what you actually do, because this is fintech, this is financial services. Yes, it involves money in every case, but what do you do with that money? Is it client money? Is it you buying and selling crypto? What are you doing? I think that really helps me to understand therefore the associated risks with your organization. And I think that's really important from my point of view, because I don't want to go in and say, you have to have a policy or a process that states that every time you leave the office to nip to the loo, you have to fill in a form. That's nonsense. That nobody needs that. What we do want is we want an effective understanding of the security requirements for your organization. Okay. So how can we apply the guidelines, and how do the guidelines apply to your organization? So an understanding of the company, and that can be through a chat or brief chat before we get there, or it can be through I always research companies' websites and try to understand a little bit about what they do first. But also give me some stuff to work with. It's also very useful sometimes to get some idea of some of your policies. So, you know, how do you do, you know, what's your policy on, you know, access management, for instance, about principle of least privilege and things like that. That those are really useful for me to get a heads up on. It's also very handy to know what sort of organization you are from a an infrastructure perspective. So do you host within AWS, within Azure, within GCP, a mixture of all three of those, or do you have data centers somewhere that where you put everything, or do you host it all in the cleaning cupboard in the office? You know, what are you doing from that side of things? So again, just understanding what's going on. I also spoke in my presentation earlier just about some of the documents which I think are really, really useful. So I just put them back up on the screen. I think you can still see my screen. Yes. I've put them back up on the screen now. Those sort of things are what we will be going through during the day. To give me some idea before we get there is always very useful. So that's what we kind of will hope. The other issue that we sometimes find is that the right people aren't sometimes available. You know, before we arrive, we always, you know, provide a list of people that we think we need. So if you could make sure those people are available, that means that you're getting the best results from us because we can speak to the best people. And also we're able to kind of close things off as quickly as we possibly can rather than, you know, 10 emails backwards and forwards.
Brilliant, Simon. Thank you. Thanks for that. Okay, Greg, in your experience, what do you find is the most common finding in an IT audit?
I think the most common one we usually come across is the PSU management. So it's guideline 9 in the previous guidelines, and in the new guidelines, I think it's 3.8. But effectively what it says is that you need to manage your PSU or payment service user. So the person that's using your systems and is a customer of yourself, you need to educate them on how to keep secure and how to use your systems in the most secure manner. And we find that that is pretty frequently not done. So that is probably the biggest high risk that comes through on our audits. The inevitable question that falls out of that is always, well, okay, what does that mean? What do I do there? And that really depends on the size of the company. And that really is when proportionality you must take proportionality into account. So for instance, if you're a small company, what you might do is just send an email to your customers every 3 months or so to remind them of their the security of your system and remind them how to keep secure themselves. If we also see that being done through blogs, a lot of companies have been introducing blogs lately to educate their customers and the wider user groups. You've probably also seen far larger companies have more formal approaches to this. So you might have seen different banks with adverts on TV talking about security and how they keep you secure and how you can always contact their security center and things like that. And vast majority of people in this call won't be doing something that official, won't be doing something that robust, but a simple email, a simple blog post is more than sufficient.
Okay. If I could just add on that as well, Elaine, just thinking that from my tech side, one of the things that I frequently see is that people have these brilliant backup and restore policies in place sometimes. You know, the guidelines state that there should be an adequate set of severe but plausible scenarios in your business continuity management, which need to be tested periodically, need to be tested regularly, they need to be documented, and deficiencies from them need to be defined. But we frequently find that people write all these things down, you know, and they say, we've got a really great business continuity plan that relies on our backups being available from X, Y, and Z. And then you ask, you know, can you show me the last time you restored your entire organization from backup, or, you know, your sensitive payment data from backup, you know, the thing that actually drives your company, there's no response. So, you know, from my point of view, I frequently see that backups aren't tested. And that for me is a major issue. It's a bit of a mantra that I get out with as often as I can, which is a backup isn't a backup until it's tested. And that testing is much better to do at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday morning than it is at 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning. It's when everything's gone wrong. So that for me would be a really critical point to try to get right.
Simon, thank you. Yeah, so it's all very well documenting these policies and processes, but if you're not actually doing what you say you're doing, that's what the audit's going to bring up. So look, another one here, you talked there about proportionality. So we'll move on to this question. Proportionality. So in terms of an IT audit of a small regulated firm with less than 10 people, is such an audit less onerous, less costly, etc.? How does this work? Simon.
So yeah, so from my point of view, I'm still looking for pretty much the same things, but obviously it's easier to understand access management in an organization that is, you know, that has very, very many fewer people. If the CTO, for instance, is working with only 3 or 4 people, then access management becomes very much more simple to manage. So I would never describe any of our audits as onerous anyway. I think that they're a useful way of understanding more about the organization and understanding your current IT audit, the IT infrastructure. But what I would say is that from a smaller company point of view, that yes, it is probably going to take less time, because there's going to be less to understand. I would also hope that in many cases the smaller organizations are taking full advantage of all the automation that's available to them. So thinking about things that if I ask what do you do from a protection point of view, and they say we have endpoint protection for all our devices using software X, here it is, boom, that's that done. We have guard duty in place on our AWS infrastructure. We have which will detect malicious activity. We have something available for all of our servers. And again, that's it. That's done. That's a very, very simple way of knocking things off the list, as it were, of proving to me that things are being done in a good way. It also is the case that we rarely see in smaller companies, it's rare to see things like access keys that haven't have been in place for, an extensive period of time.
Okay, thank you. Simon, I'm going to jump to another question just because you've mentioned their automation. So there's another question here about, you talk about automation of certain areas of IT. Is there any way you can automate the internal IT audit?
So automating it is, there are vulnerability scanners out there that you can buy, they're great products, things like Nessus from Tenable, great piece of kit, which will help you to understand how your internal systems are patched, any vulnerabilities in your systems, and presenting a report like that to me is great, because it means that, I can just have a flick through, see the date that it was last done, and that's really useful. But that's just one part of it, really. Automation of the entire IT audit is more difficult, because what you've got to then think about is how does the automation understand the risks that are associated with a cyber attack on your system? How do you assess and rate those risks? So that side of things is much more complicated to sort out. But providing reports from your automation software for things like security scorecard, which gives you information about suppliers, for things like internal scanning, for things like security and penetration testing reports, guard duty, antivirus software that reports issues, things like that, they really genuinely do benefit. And it means that, we can see them straight away. There it is, screenshot, evidence, boom, we've got that item in there. So there are ways in which you can make it easier. But the automation of the whole thing, not so much, but definitely there are ways in which you can make it easier for us and for yourself.
Okay, great. Thanks, Simon, for that. Greg, if we could move to you then on this one, this is a good one. Have you had any feedback you can share from audit reports shared with the FCA?
Unfortunately not. I would like to maybe posit that that's because they're such good quality and the FCA don't need to respond to them in any way whatsoever. They just tick that box. But unfortunately not. We haven't had any direct feedback on what from the FCA in regards to the audit reports, and the way the audit reports would have made it to them would have been through whether they directly request it or it's requested through the Repo 1-8. Haven't received anything like that in that regard. I think it's quite likely that the FCA haven't picked up the Repo 1-8s and picked up this side of things as robustly as they have other reporting obligations, and that is because of its unstructured format. So when does that pick up? I'm not entirely sure, but well, I suppose we haven't received anything yet. But you know, we've submitted and helped people submit quite a few of them. If somebody knows, we'll probably be the first ones to know when the FCA start asking questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Greg. Greg, I'll ask you the next one as well, if you don't mind. Okay, so what should we expect after the EBA guidelines come into practice on the 30th of June? What will we see that may be different from the regulator? And will they visit more, issue more fines? What do you think will happen?
So to possibly alleviate some worry, I don't think these guidelines are going to be a driver for more fines or more enforcement necessarily from the FCA. I think we will naturally see that as the FCA continue to advance their enforcement strategy around cybersecurity and around operational resilience. I think we can expect that, but these guidelines won't necessarily be the driver for that. Realistically, what the most likely area we're likely to see the FCA speak to these guidelines directly is, as I keep mentioning, the Repo 1-8, and that is because the way you approach risk assessments may slightly change with these new guidelines, and I touched on it previously, but one of the areas is risk assessments. You should be grading scoring your assets against the CIA triad, and that isn't something that is always in risk assessments, and it isn't something that is hugely common in risk assessments, but it is something that you'll probably want to introduce as part of your Repo 1-8. Whether the Repo 1-8 goes through an actual structural change, or the FCA expects you to report it in a different format, we're yet to know. The FCA unfortunately have got COVID-19 issues on their plate at the moment, so that is that's something that we're keeping an eye on. We'll be sure to you know, post about if we do hear anything else from the FCA. But I think it is quite likely that what will end up happening is the report will stay the same in structure. It's just what you're submitting to the FCA may slightly change, with one of those critical areas being the grading of the underlying asset.
Okay, Greg, thank you. So it's a wait and see, but we'll obviously keep everyone updated if we hear anything through blogs, etc., from our FSCom website and social media. So okay, moving on to the next question, and I think we'll go to Simon then for this one. Simon, if we have ISO 27001, are we covered in terms of these audits?
So 27001 is a fantastic certification to have. I think it's a really useful one to be aware of. We've helped lots of organisations get to 27001, you know, it does provide a lot of support for these audits, because what we're talking about there is coverage of risk, its coverage of assets, it's got lots and lots of different areas contained within physical environmental security, operational security, access control, all things that I've been gassing on about for the last wee while. What the IT audit actually does is it gathers all those things together into the right format for the guidelines. Okay, so what we're looking at from these specific IT audit section is about the guidelines from the EBA. Okay, so it helps to, you know, the section about detection, for instance, and protection, it's relatively vague, or it doesn't say in the ISO 27001, you shall do it this way, or you shall do this. It says you take a risk-based approach to pretty much everything that you do. Whereas the EBA guidelines are a bit more specific about what you have to do. So it specifies that you have to do penetration testing once a year for critical systems, and every 3 years for non-critical systems, things like that, which aren't actually mentioned in, they're not as specific in the ISO 27001. So it's about blending the two things together. So while it won't, it won't solve all of the, it doesn't kind of solve everything. What it does do is it helps us to know that you have an effective security policy, for instance, know that you have effective access management policies. And it's then a case of just bringing that data to us and bringing that information to us. So that can be very, very handy to be able to do.
Brilliant, Simon, thank you. And it's a very, it's a very detailed standard to achieve, and FSCom, we're actually in the process ourselves of going through that authorization process. So you'll soon hopefully hear some good news around that for us. So moving on to the next question then, one for Greg, please. How does FSCom align their IT audit process with the current IT and security risks being faced by the industry as a whole?
Yeah, so the process itself, as Simon has kind of chatted through it throughout that presentation, is designed not only around the guidelines, but around what we usually see within the industry. So we briefly touched on this when we talked about what are some of the common failings that we find in these audits. I mentioned the PSU management, and Simon mentioned the practical and actual application of scenario-based testing within your business continuity plan. And those are areas that we're going to go pretty quickly towards because of our experience specifically within the payments and e-money environment. We know the areas that that your competitors are filling in, and we know the areas which to poke, which usually are fairly sore to poke. So that is that does govern how we are looking at these audits and how we approach them practically. But the framework stays the same fairly consistently, and that is the EBA guidelines, and if you request it, the regulatory technical standards, that audit requirement tagged onto that as well.
Okay, thank you, Greg. This last question, I think we have time for one or two more questions. I think you may already have answered this, but I'll ask it anyway. How does it all tie in with the audit required with the RTS?
To touch on very briefly touched on it there. Practically speaking, the best way, or the way we suggest to approach this, is that you bundle in the RTS audit and the EBA guidelines audit into one audit. And that is simply because you don't want to be dealing with auditors, more times than you necessarily have to. So if you look at a normal payment institution, you might have an AML audit 1 month, you may have IT security audit 1 month. If you separate the RTS audit, that's another audit, and then you may have a safeguarding or a PSRs audit as well, so an audit of your entire compliance system. And that doesn't include if you need to get a financial audit for accountancy purposes. So you'd we try to limit them as much as possible. So I would suggest that if you're due an RTS audit, and that the RTS doesn't specifically tell you a date and that you have to have it done unless you are availing of the Article 18 exemption, transactional risk analysis. So unless you're availing of that, it says periodically, effectively. And these guidelines effectively say the same thing. You should be applying this periodically. We usually say once a year is gold standard, and you may be able to get away with a bit longer, just depending what changes on your systems as well. If everything has remained utterly the same, then you may be able to extend that out. If things have changed, you've got a new CRM system in, you've changed your cloud infrastructure, then that's obviously going to feed into whether you need an audit more frequently. But to kind of separate out the two, the EBA guidelines are effectively what Simon has talked about there and have been the major focus of this. And then you have the RTS audit, and that looks at really quite specifically strong customer authentication and open banking. And the audit principles are pretty much the same. We would come in, we'll test it, and we probably do that in the same vein that we would do the guidelines audit. The only difference is we would be zoning in quite specifically on your open banking APIs, so that they're actually working, that you aren't creating unnecessary obstacles for TPPs that are accessing the system. And we zone in quite specifically on to strong customer authentication. So whenever a customer logs in, are they passing two-factor authentication? Is an authentication code created? Is that authentication code dynamically linked? Those are the differences, but we would really look to capture them in the same audit if we were on site or this new world of remote, if we were doing remote audit.
Brilliant. Greg, thank you. Look, watching our time, I think we'll leave it there. And any questions that we haven't answered, we'll follow up after this session today. So look, thank you so much, Simon and Greg, for sharing your words of wisdom. I'm sure everybody find that useful and of benefit in preparing for their IT audits. So the recording will be available in the follow-up email and then on our website shortly, along with all the other previous webinars, which you then can watch on demand. Look, we're running another webinar tomorrow. So if you haven't signed up for it, it's everything you should know about drafting a wind down plan, which is also something the FCA are looking at as a priority. And then our safeguarding webinar on the 2nd of July, which is another area of focus for the FCA at the moment, especially with that the recent consultation. So look, thank you, Greg and Simon, and thank you to everyone for their participation this afternoon. Take care and stay safe, and we'll see you at the next one.
Thanks, Lane. Thanks, everyone.